Our next and final case is State versus Coleman. State versus Coleman. Ready.
May it please the court, my name is Jason Troia, and I'm here arguing on behalf of the appellant, Michael Coleman. His main request is that this court remand this case back to the district court of Douglas County and order an evidentiary hearing. If not, at a minimum, order the district court to make some specific findings as opposed to just having issued the order that it did, where it kind of generally denied all of his claims for alternative reasons without specifically addressing any of them. He's broken them down into two basic categories. He's got the ineffective assistance of counsel arguments, and he's got two separate due process arguments. The due process arguments that he's alleged in this post-conviction action have to do with the sufficiency of the evidence and the identification that was made by one of the witnesses.
Could either or both of these have been challenged as evidentiary errors on direct appeal?
Could either of them? The one with respect to the sufficiency of the evidence, yes, and it was one of the assigned errors. The challenge to the in-court identification by one of the witnesses, or out of court, either of them, wasn't challenged, and so that would have had to come in through ineffective assistance claim. The way it's, as I understand the argument, and the way it's referenced in the brief, is in light of how this identification was made by one of the witnesses, and we're talking about Mr. Ray, in light of how that came about, if the court had all that information, if the jury had all that information, had been properly challenged, that would have affected the sufficiency of the evidence that was would have been available to try and convict him. So you have to look at those two combined. So it's kind of like, well, if it had been successfully challenged initially on post-conviction, he's saying, we don't have sufficiency of the evidence to hold me in prison. I mean, he was essentially given a de facto.
But the witness identification itself could have been challenged at trial.
That's correct.
Right. So you're raising it here as a due process argument.
Correct.
Not as an ineffective assistance argument. So is it not waived because it could have been brought?
It's argued both ways, or at least it's attempted to be argued both ways.
Right. We'll get to the ineffective assistance in a minute, but under the due process, it's waived, right? The court's right that that's procedurally barred from raising that claim.
Unless it's a new claim that factors in both the evidence presented and how the evidence would have presented if it had been properly challenged, if that makes sense. He's basically saying, for my due process argument, look at how this case would have been presented to a jury if my trial attorney would have successfully challenged this identification. The evidence would have been different. And how about if my trial counsel would have properly impeached the witnesses or brought about their inconsistencies? For example, how Mr. Jones, that witness's testimony came in by way of a stipulation, he had a different version and sequence of events than the main witness, Mr. Ray. And what I mean by that is, or to expound on that, is when Mr. Ray testified, he says he walks out with Mr. Jones. He goes to the trunk of his vehicle. He's getting out a microwave that he had borrowed from Mr. Jones, and he's going to be return it to Mr. Jones. And it's at that point in time where he hears the pop sound, which to him initially sounds like, you know, a car running over a beer bottle or something of that, a glass bottle. And so then he looks to Mr. Jones and says, that sounds like a shot. When Mr. Jones gave his account to the police, he says, well, yeah, I'm walking out of the establishment and I see this truck go zooming west through the parking lot. So he's in a completely different position and seeing a completely different part of the altercation than how the key witness relayed the information.
So are you talking about the ineffective assistance claim now when you're making this one?
I'm combining them. What I'm trying to explain is, with the due process argument, he's asking the court to consider what the evidence would have looked like had his trial counsel not been ineffective in the ways in which he was, because it would have been a different version relayed to the jury.
Okay. So I want to get to the ineffective assistance quickly. So there's a number of ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims made here, but during the direct appeal, there was different appeal counsel than there was trial counsel. Are those not barred? The ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims are now barred because they weren't raised by appellate counsel, correct?
Unless they come in through layered claims.
And do you take the position that those were pled then as layered claims here? Because the state takes the position they were not.
Well, they could have been more artfully alleged and argued. But if you look at the brief and you look at the petition as a whole, I think you can see what the appellate counsel who drafted the brief was trying to argue. Otherwise, it's just, well, my appellate counsel was ineffective for just generally arguing trial counsel was ineffective. Yet I have all these arguments how trial counsel is ineffective. Why am I just supposed to ignore those? Like, I'm not saying he should have alleged those on direct appeal.
Yeah.
I don't think that makes sense, but I understand why you're asking this.
No, it's not a model of clarity.
Yes.
Right.
So he's got the due process, the first due process argument, the second one, as it relates to the identification. And then going through the ineffective arguments. The first one that he raises has to do with an officer, Martinick, that provided some testimony at trial. And the issue that he takes up with that is his trial counsel should have challenged him, should have challenged Officer Martinick's testimony on the difference in how our victim, Mr. Stella, reported what he saw, his initial observations. And so what he claims here is that initially, the extent of Mr. Stella's eyewitness account of what had just happened was there's a dark figure with something bouncing on his head. But then that gets turned into, well, it's a black male and those are dreads. Oh, and he's got a red shirt. So the way it was testified in court, this witness account from the victim, is that it more appropriately fits or more consistently fits with how Mr. Coleman was dressed and presented himself that evening. And that's his overall concern a lot of these challenges on why his trial counsel didn't effectively represent him is because you've got discrepancies in witness accounts. But by the time it gets to trial, they seem to fit a lot more consistently than when they were initially reported. And so what changed? Usually people's observations and memories get worse over time. Now they more closely resemble Mr. Coleman and what his position is. Hey, look, I've been wrongfully identified as being the shooter here. No one saw the shooting. People gave different accounts of what they saw after the shooting, and they're inconsistent. But those inconsistencies weren't portrayed in the trial, because by the time it gets to trial, they all seem to mesh up a lot better than they were initially reported.
So I thought Stella provided Officer Martinick a more descriptive description at the hospital following his injury, that he had dreads, that he was a black male with dreads and a red shirt. And then it was at trial that he got more vague. So you're saying it was the opposite.
Right. The very initial report, that's my understanding of how it's been alleged here, that it was the extent of what he provided was dark figure with something bouncing on his head.
I think that was the trial testimony.
Okay.
But to Judge Bishop's point, a year earlier when he was in the hospital and Martinick's interviewing him and he's got his cam on, that's when he's more descriptive.
Okay.
Right. So it's the opposite.
And that may be, I don't have that citation to quickly find that in a short amount of time, and I apologize for that. I'm close out of time. I would ask this court to consider the arguments that are presented in the brief and the reply brief.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Jordan Osborne, Assistant Attorney General, representing the appellee of the state of Nebraska. The appellant's motion for post-conviction relief was properly denied without an evidentiary hearing because appellant's claims were either procedurally barred, insufficiently pled, or the record and files affirmatively show he was entitled to no relief. Assignments of error 2 through 5 are procedurally barred. One of those claims reasserts his insufficiency of the evidence claim that was rejected by this court on direct appeal. Claims of insufficiency of the evidence that were could have been raised on direct appeal are procedurally barred from being brought on for post-conviction in a post-conviction action. Appellant also asserts a denial of due process because of an alleged unnecessarily suggestive identification of him by a witness. That claim is procedurally barred because it could have been raised on direct appeal and it was not. So, and then as to whether this claim is procedurally barred, these claims, it's a question of law for this court to determine. So the specific content of the district court's order regarding these claims is not relevant. The records and files affirmatively show that post-conviction relief for these claims is procedurally barred, and this court can make that finding without considering what the district court said in its order. So the next issue then is layered ineffective claims. Appellant was represented by new counsel on direct appeal, and his ineffective claims were not properly preserved on direct appeal. This made any ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims alleged on post-conviction review procedurally barred unless they were properly layered claims that alleged appellate counsel's failure to raise trial counsel's ineffective assistance on direct appeal. Appellant's post-conviction motion alleges several ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims, and then also alleges an appellate counsel that appellate counsel performed efficiently by not specifically stating in the appellant's brief on direct appeal how trial counsel was ineffective. So he's specifically referring to appellate counsel's failure to comply with State versus Mirza by failing to assign the trial counsel's deficient performance on direct appeal, which resulted in those claims not being preserved. So then if you look at the appellant's direct appeal brief, there's only two ineffective claims raised in that brief. Deficiency wasn't specifically assigned, but they are argued in the argument section of the brief. And only one of those two claims is then reasserted in the post-conviction motion. Nowhere in the post-conviction motion does appellant allege that his appellate counsel failed to raise the additional or the new claims of ineffective assistance of trial counsel that appear in his motion for post-conviction relief.
So it's your position that a layered claim cannot be asserted against post-conviction counsel. Well, can't be against appellate counsel by setting forth all of the ways in which trial counsel was defective and then saying an appellate counsel was defective for not asserting.
If he wants to properly layer the claim, the way that it should have been phrased is how it was phrased to preserve the original claims that were made on direct appeal, the two that original direct appeal counsel asserted, but didn't properly assign pursuant to Mirza, but then also state appellate counsel is ineffective for not asserting these new claims that have never been raised before. And that's not an allegation that appears in the post-conviction motion. The claim also does not incorporate or refer to any of the prior arguments in the motion. So they lay out all the ineffective assistance of trial counsel arguments, but at the very end, I think it's paragraphs 65 and 66. There's nothing in those paragraphs that refers back to any of those other prior claims about ineffective trial counsel.
Basically, it could be read that he's referring to all these preceding claims against trial counsel I'm now raising against appellate counsel in a layered way. It was, as Mr. Troia conceded, not artfully drafted, but could be read that here I'm laying out all the trial counsel's ineffective performances, and now here I'm capturing them all. It's like a catch-all for the appellate counsel.
I would disagree with that, because the way that it's written, it specifically refers to the claims that were raised in the direct appeal. It doesn't refer to the new claims that he's making in his post-conviction motion. So as to the original claims that were made, only one of which was reasserted in the post-conviction motion, that's properly layered. That one claim was properly layered. The new claims were not. And so as to that one claim, I can address that very briefly. And then if the court has questions about the other ineffective claims, I can address those. So that claim, as Mr. Troy mentioned, involves a conflict of in the evidence related to the victim's description of the shooter, and the trial counsel was ineffective in failing to cross-examine specifically Officer Martinek about that conflict. So at trial, Officer Martinek testified that his body camera recorded the victim at the hospital describing the shooter as a black male with dreadlocks and a red shirt. And then the victim testified a year later at trial that he saw a dark image with something moving on top of the shooter's head like long hair. Officer Martinek did not have personal knowledge of what the victim saw. And so trial counsel could not impeach the officer on any conflict between those descriptions. Only the victim could have been questioned about those any conflict in that description, because it's his description that he's providing. The alleged error is not that trial counsel failed to cross-examine the victim, it's that he failed to cross-examine Officer Martinek. The state also would disagree with the characterization that it's even inconsistent at all. It's not inconsistent for a victim to have a better recollection of a shooter's description minutes after it happened than a year later at trial. And then finally, there's no prejudice, because the jury heard both of those statements and was aware of any alleged conflict or inconsistency between them. For all those reasons, the record affirmatively shows that the trial counsel was not ineffective on this claim. The defendant was also not prejudiced by appellate counsel's failure to properly assign that error on direct appeal. So the district court properly denied appellant's motion for post-conviction relief without an evidentiary hearing. If this court wishes to discuss any of the other claims, I can address those.
How about if you just briefly address the issue with respect to Officer Ray, is it, and the lineup, and his suggestion that because he first observed him and then went in and looked at the video surveillance before he ultimately gave a description, that violates right.
The claim of a unnecessarily suggestive identification. So the appellant can't show that trial counsel performed efficiently in this regard. There's a two-part test for admissibility of an out-of-court statement. Trial court must decide whether the police arranged an unnecessarily suggestive identification procedure, and second, if they did, whether that improper procedure tainted the resulting identification such to render it unreliable, which meaning that there is a very substantial likelihood of irreparable misidentification. So the first part of that, appellant can't show that there was any suggestiveness. Suggestiveness is conduct or circumstances that tell a witness who to pick. That's the person right there. That's the guilty party. But here, Ray is reviewing surveillance video that nobody has ever seen before, including law enforcement. It depicts dozens of people inside of a sports bar that are engaged in totally innocuous conduct. So there's nothing in the video itself that's suggestive about which one of these people Ray should be identifying. Law enforcement could not have suggested who he should pick because law enforcement hasn't seen the video. They don't know what's on there. They're viewing this 15 to 20 minutes after the shooting. And at that time, Ray had already given a detailed description of the suspect in his 911 call. Black male, 5'7" to 5'8" tall, long dreadlocks, wearing a red Nike t-shirt. That's pretty specific. This description was given about 30 seconds after the shooting, long before any officers ever arrived. He also provided a detailed description of the suspect vehicle that included an entire, a complete license plate number. So they can't show the first prong of that. They also can't show that it was unreliable.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I'd ask you to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. How much time does Mr. Troy have left?
41 seconds.
I just want to use that to apologize. That I did find the citation in that 10 minutes that I was sitting down. So the inference is that the, you know, including Ray, Mr. Ray, who's an off-duty officer, is that the police are making this fit perfectly. And so that's why they're saying that even though Mr. Stella only saw a blurry dark figure with something on top of his head, now all of a sudden it's, oh no, he gave a more accurate description. That's the inference that he's alleging. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Case is submitted. Counsel is excused. That concludes the June panel.